Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Goldstein. My attorney registration number is 24658. I represent Nicholas Smiley, the appellant. It's my position, Mr. Smiley's position, that the trial court findings of proximate cause are not supported by the record. The facts of this case, or procedurally, what occurred is the co-defendant, the primary assailant, went to trial. Mr. Smiley took advantage of a favorable disposition and pleaded guilty to a class 4 felony, second degree assault drugging, which was clearly an Alford plea, which avoided a mandatory prison sentence. He received a 2-year deferred judgment and sentence on that charge, and then a straight plea to a third degree assault misdemeanor. It was clearly set out that he was reserving the right to contest restitution. So I think from the get-go, it's important to know that there was never a waiver of the right to contest restitution. And I think the record supports that position because both the court and the prosecution relied on the evidence that was presented at the co-defendant's trial. I think it's also important to note that both the prosecutor and the trial judge were also the prosecutor and trial judge who presided over the co-defendant's trial. At no time did the prosecutor stand up and say we shouldn't even be having a discussion about restitution because there was a plea agreement. So certainly this is not a waiver issue. So I would like to dispose of that early on. I ask that the record on appeal be supplemented with the co-defendant's trial because both the prosecutor and the trial judge relied on essentially their memories of what occurred at Elric Gilman's trial to essentially assert that there was proximate cause. However, I went through in detail of the co-defendant's jury trial, and I think it's very clear that there were actually two different fisticuffs going on that evening. I certainly think that alcohol exacerbated the situation. There was definitely contradictory testimony as to what occurred. However, there were three witnesses, Fender, Sanchez, and Leyva, who were all very clear that my client, Mr. Smiley, was basically getting the worst of it from a larger woman by the name of Kristen Rubottom, while the co-defendant, Gilman, was engaged in a fist fight with the victim. That tragic event occurred behind, I believe, a Jeep Cherokee, while the witnesses who I've mentioned were clearly able to view Mr. Smiley getting the worst of it. Indeed, one of the witnesses characterized my client as what he thought was a young child wearing a green tank top and being beaten by Kristen Rubottom. The police also ultimately looked at the witnesses and the participants in this and noticed that Ms. Rubottom had major damage to her fingers, indicating that she had been punching Mr. Smiley. What I think is also important is that Mr. Fender, who was the driver of the vehicle in which Gilman and Mr. Smiley came in, he remained in the vehicle. He was clear that Mr. Smiley was getting away from Ms. Rubottom, got into the car to evade Ms. Rubottom, while Mr. Gilman and the victim were continuing to engage in fisticuffs. So I do not believe that the record establishes proximate cause that my client, but for my client's actions, that the victim sustained injuries.
Ms. Goldstein, there's a difference between reserving the right to contest the amount of restitution and reserving the right to contest the the fact of restitution altogether. Is it your statement today, or are you arguing that Mr. Smiley specifically said, "I'm reserving the right to argue that I'm not going to have to be responsible for restitution at all"?
I do not recall the specific words that trial counsel used, but I believe the thrust of it was clear that they were arguing that Mr. Smiley was not proximately responsible.
Then why would he plead, and why would he agree to the stipulation of facts that would support that plea?
Okay, well, I think there's two things going on here which are important. The fact that a defendant looks at the case, sits down with trial counsel, in this case, and I am not making light of this, the victim died, and certainly that is something that would cause many people to pause and concern. I believe the co-defendant actually went to trial and they charged him with first-degree murder. He was acquitted of first-degree murder, but certainly the prosecution took this case very seriously. So the fact that Mr. Smiley ended up taking a very favorable disposition says several things about the case. One, I think the prosecution knew that Mr. Smiley was not engaged in that fisticuffs with it and offered Mr. Smiley a deferred judgment sentence. And it wasn't even a lengthy deferred judgment sentence. It was a 2-year deferred judgment sentence. Besides that point, the fact that Mr. Smiley decided to take an Alford plea does not relieve the trial court of its duty to find, before imposing restitution, that there is proximate cause for those actions. And what I think is also important is, again, both the prosecutor and the trial court were relying on the facts that were laid out in the co-defendant's trial. And certainly, I believe Mr. Smiley's trial lawyer was at a disadvantage because Mr. Smiley's trial lawyer was not at that trial. So he was not able to argue essentially what the witnesses ultimately testified to at trial.
The trial court didn't say, "I give no weight at all to the fact that the defendant pleaded guilty to two separate assaults on the AA, the victim"?
I believe, if I recall correctly, Judge, what I think happened is the trial court really did focus on, and I think that's cited in the written order and the answer brief, about the facts of the co-defendant's trial. So I don't believe that the trial court just relied on the guilty plea.
And I'm not suggesting that he only relied on that, but he didn't exclude those facts as something that he took into consideration, did he?
I don't believe he specifically excluded it. Conversely, I don't think he specifically relied on that either.
Fair enough. And then also, there was evidence that the defendant stated, I think to the police, but I'm not sure, that he actually swung at AA at one point. He wasn't sure and thought he didn't hit him, but he did admit that he actually swung at the victim.
Right. And I think what came out in trial is they actually had an expert from CBI testify that there was no DNA evidence found on Mr. Smiley. They looked at his hands, his clothing, testing. Besides the lack of scientific evidence tying that, we have three different witnesses who show Mr. Smiley was off on the side being beat up by Kristen Rubottom. So while this melee is happening, the chaos over here between co-defendant and the victim was occurring.
Is there anything in the record about the distance between these two events?
I don't believe anyone was able to really give distances. And certainly there were a variety of witnesses who testified, including two essentially young witnesses who said that the primary assailant had long blonde hair when clearly there was no one there with long blonde hair. So I think there was a lot of confusion, chaos. This happened at night.
And the other question I have is, how did this start? What prompted this whole thing?
I believe what occurred from reading the co-defendant's trial, the three people in the car, Fender, Smiley, and Elric Gilman, pulled up in the driveway. Mr. Gilman and Smiley went into the residence for a few minutes. Mr. Fender remained there. They were coming back to the car. I believe they might have gotten into the car or were close to the car when they heard mouthy, perhaps instigating, drunken comments. And as a result of that, Mr. Smiley and Mr. Gilman took off. And I think it's pretty clear Mr. Gilman became embroiled in a situation with the victim, whereas Mr. Smiley was on the other side, engaged in a confrontation with this larger woman.
But they both, did they both go to the same, this altercation at the same time, Mr. Gilman and Mr. Smiley?
I believe that's what the evidence, or what the testimony was, yes.
I mean, our problem is we don't get to decide from scratch what we think the right result is. We have to look at what the result was and look at whether there's evidence in the record to support it. And we have the fact that these two gentlemen entered the fracas, or whatever you want to call it, at the same time. There's evidence that Mr. Smiley swung at AA, and there's the pleas. So why is that not sufficient evidence to support the findings?
Well,
the result.
That's a two-part question. I'll take the latter again.
It is a compound question, I agree.
The fact of a plea in and of itself does not relieve the trial court of its duty to find proximate cause. And I've looked for cases, and I don't see any cases, nor do I believe the state cited any cases that show because of a plea that eradicates the trial court's duty to find proximate cause before imposing restitution. So that's one thing. The second thing is, there was conflicting testimony. However, the witnesses that I cited to said that they never saw Mr. Smiley throw a punch at the victim, and that he was engaged over here on the other side, where Mr. Leyva clearly had a view of a smaller man being engaged in a fracas with a larger woman. Mr. Fender, who was in the car, was clear that the confrontation between the other two was ongoing as Mr. Smiley jumped into the car to evade Ms. Rubottom. So I think what's going on here is this was not a joint melee where there were four people all together throwing punches. There were two very separate altercations going on. And I know I have very few minutes left. One of the things that I want to also bring up is that the trial court also imposed restitution costs for the victim's parents to travel to co-defendant's trial and impose that jointly and severally for my client. And I don't see under a proximate cause analysis how the court gets to award travel expenses to a co-defendant's trial against my client. Certainly, I don't think it was the but for the actions of the co-defendant pleading not guilty, which does not have anything to do with my client. Additionally, the restitution statute is mandatory that restitution must be imposed within 90 days. The record's pretty clear. He was sentenced in the end of April. The state filed a motion for restitution right at the end of July, about 2 days before the 90-day cutoff. And then subsequently, after the restitution hearing, filed another request for restitution for Jennifer Halflich, which was the victim's girlfriend. So I don't believe under TURSEC that the court was properly allowed to even consider that. And again, to get back to my original argument, I don't believe there's any proximate cause for the victim, nor for Jennifer Halflich. And I'm certain, I think there's a lot of issues about whether or not she can even be considered a victim in this case, because she was not a named victim. And again, aside from that issue, the testimony is clear that Mr. Smiley had nothing to do with Jennifer Haflich and the injuries that she did sustain that night. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Goldstein.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. In pleading guilty, the defendant admitted his involvement in assaulting AA that resulted in his death, and he cannot now argue that he's not responsible for the restitution amount because he's innocent of that crime. Rather, as I think this court's questions have revealed and this court's cases have made clear, the defendant must show that the trial court abused its discretion in ordering him to pay restitution. He hasn't done that here. Now, there are three restitution amounts in the trial court's order at issue today. One, the medical expenses for AA. Two, Jennifer Haflich's therapy and lost wages. And three, the expenses that Haflich incurred in terminating her lease and storing her belongings.
How do you address proximate cause?
Well, in this case, I guess to me, the arguments in this case largely seem to be two ships passing the night. The defendant's principal argument is that the people did not prove proximate cause because he didn't commit the crime. In this case, he pled guilty to assaulting AA, third-degree assault, and he admitted that he stipulated there was a factual basis for that plea. So based on that, and the fact that I think the record's largely undisputed that through that assault, the victim incurred medical expenses and ultimately died, that provided an ample basis for the trial court's finding that there was proximate cause.
Let me just ask you, why is any restitution owed under Turecik? There was no restitution order entered within 90 days of the conviction. So why is there any restitution at issue at all?
Well, under the original, when the court accepted the guilty plea, as a condition of the plea, it said that restitution would be ordered at a later date. And I think under the restitution statute, a court can issue that order and extend it beyond the 90 days.
What was the good cause shown?
I think for the basis, unfortunately, well, let me answer that in two ways. So one, given that the provency hearing is not included on the record of appeal, I think we have to presume that the trial court did act correctly and that there was in fact good cause. So I think the lack of the record presented for review, that alone resolves that issue. But to offer at least my explanation for why I think it's extended, I think they're waiting for the conclusion of the co-defendant's trial. Because again, if we look at the restitution hearing, which is really the only thing we have in this case, the co-defendant's trial was a little before the guilty plea was accepted in this case. But we don't know when the sentencing was, but I'm guessing that the sentencing hearing, because that trial involved more serious charges, trailed a few months after the co-defendant's trial. So I think the idea and the good cause was, but again, we don't know because we don't have the proficiency hearing, is that the trial court extended the period so that it could be heard at the same time, as it was, as we know, in the restitution hearing that we do have. So we could do both the defendant and the co-defendant at the same time. So I would say on those two grounds, Turecik is certainly distinguishable. On a different factual ground, I really think the problem in Turecik was, in that case, it was an arson case. So the problem there was the court that the people should have known right away what the costs it would be trying to recover. In this case, the defendant hasn't disputed the restitution amount as to AA's medical expenses or to Haflich's medical expenses or therapy, or lost wages or therapy costs. They've only raised the Turecik argument as it relates to her lease termination and storage expense fees. And so on that ground, I think Turecik is clearly distinguishable because unlike Turecik, that's not something that the prosecution would naturally think might actually flow from the defendant's conduct, although certainly it was the proximate cause. Unlike an arson case where you know that the damage to the house is something that's gonna be compensable in restitution. In this case, the prosecution, it's not as obvious that that would be something that they would want to get in restitution. And as the record reveals, the prosecutor brought up that amount the day after it was brought to their attention. So on that ground, I'd argue that, or on those two grounds, one, that they're only challenging that third grouping of expenses, and that there was good cause for that third grouping, that Turecik is just not applicable in this case.
Good cause wasn't shown, though, was it?
It seems like it was implied. The trial court, the prosecutor brought it up and said, we just found out about this third expense yesterday. And the trial court allowed them the chance to amend and then later entered orders and finding in accepting it. So I think there was an implied finding of good cause. But again, I don't even think we get there because when we start from the very first instance with the defendant's guilty plea, when they extended it beyond the 90 days, that alone puts outside the statute. Under the statute, once the trial court decides to make it outside the 90-day deadline, we don't need additional good cause to amend before the restitution order enters. So again, I think the record would disclose there was good cause for that late one because it's trailing co-defendant's trial. But secondly, just because given the fact that there is no, we don't have the prompt to hearing, I think this court has to presume that the trial court did correctly find good cause and acted appropriately under, I think, the cases we cited in the brief, Quintero, DSL, and Clendenin, that any omissions in the record weigh in the trial court's favor. Turning just back quickly to the proximate cause issue, the central problem or burden with the defense argument is I don't think it adequately grapples with the limited inquiry presented before the court. In a restitution hearing, the people have to prove that there is a sufficient nexus between the amount of losses that they're trying to get back and that the defendant's conduct caused it. But when we're dealing with a guilty plea or a jury's verdict, we don't have to again prove the defendant's underlying guilt on those offenses, which is pretty much the defense only argument in this case, is that if we look at the co-defendant's trial, it reveals that the defendant didn't commit the crime he pled guilty to. But his guilty plea forecloses that inquiry. Additionally, again, as this court pointed out, he did stipulate a factual basis for that plea. And the promptancy hearing isn't included on the record on appeal. And as we know, often in promptancy hearings, we set forth the facts that would be proven. We don't have that here. So we have absolutely no idea what the factual basis was for that third degree assault conviction, other than it was against the victim. As a final matter, I would just say based, and I think as this court has already pointed out, the issue really isn't what happened in the co-defendant's trial. The issue is whether the record in this case supports the trial court's judgment. And in addition to the defense guilty plea, as the court pointed out, the defendant also submitted a letter before sentencing admitting that he took a swing at the victim. So based on that evidence in the guilty plea, the record amply supports the trial court's determination that the defendant was involved in this altercation that led to the restitution amounts that were later requested for AA and for Havlick.
If we are otherwise inclined to consider the Turecek argument, is the defendant foreclosed from raising that because it wasn't raised in the trial court?
Possibly under Turecek itself, because I think even Turecek actually used that against us in our case, saying one of the grounds we argued on appeal couldn't be pursued because it was never presented at the trial court. So to the extent, so for the first two groupings of expenses, I'd say yes, the defendant is precluded from.
Yeah, I'm thinking just about the lease and storage costs.
Yeah, I don't, the Turecek argument wasn't, they objected to it, but I don't think they objected to it on the Turecek ground. So yes, I'd argue
so that. So is it plain error or is it totally foreclosed?
I would say that the result would be the same because if it is plain error, if it's waived, it's just gone. If it's plain error, I don't think it's defending can show neither that it's obvious nor is it substantial.
Turecek seemed to reject the idea of there being a harmless error type of defense to be made or a harmless error response to be made. Does that not allow the defendant to raise it without having to clear up plain error hurdle?
Well, I think the holding in Turecek was that it was harmless. You couldn't raise harmless in respect to the notice requirement. The fact that we can argue that it could enter because the defendant was always aware of the jurisdictional time limit. I think it's a different issue when everyone is aware and considers the issue. But as a more fundamental matter, I would just return to my argument that there's no dispute in this case. The defendant pled guilty on May 2nd. His hearing, the restitution hearing, wasn't entered until November, I think, 30th. So based on the undisputed record at that provency hearing, which we don't have, it was extended beyond that date for all the restitution expenses.
At the provency hearing, it was extended?
Well, it's when the court accepted the guilty plea, because as a condition of his guilty plea, it ordered that he'd have to pay restitution.
Yes. But statute requires that that be done within 90 days.
Unless the court extends it for good cause. And the court did extend it beyond the 90 days at the first instance. And again, the defendant's not challenging.
I'm sorry, where do you get that?
I'm just getting from, if we just look at the two times, we're dealing with more than 90 days between the time that the restitution hearing was held.
You're saying we must presume because we don't have
the record, yes, that the court.
We must presume that it extended it.
Yes. And again, to the points I made earlier, that I think even if we didn't, we can infer a good cause just based on, if we look how the restitution hearing was held, it looks like what the trial court was trying to do was do both at the same time, both the co-defendants and the defendants. And if the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm the trial court's restitution order. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Goldstein.
I submit to the court, if this was a waiver by operation of the plea agreement, we would not be here today. The prosecutor would not have even argued proximate cause and relied on what happened at the co-defendant's trial.
I think it's and I'll let you go after the light to answer this, but I don't think there's a waiver argument. I think the argument is that that is evidence that the trial court could legitimately consider, the fact that there was an admission made by the defendant.
The problem with that is I don't believe the trial court specifically relied on the guilty plea. I believe the record shows that the trial court and the prosecutor were essentially having this conversation with each other while Mr. Smiley's trial lawyer kind of sat there without anything to add to it, and they kind of said, oh yeah, we should kind of rely on what happened at the co-defendant's trial. So at no time did the trial court say, we don't even have to address this issue because he pled guilty.
Well, that isn't the issue. I don't think, does the trial court have to say we don't even have to address it, or can the trial court say address whatever you want to, but he can still take into account the fact that the defendant pled guilty to assaulting the victim twice, and in a letter to the judge said, I took a swing at him.
That letter came after the plea and sentencing, which I would suggest to the court is a way of trying to acknowledge responsibility favorably as it viewed as he was requesting a sentence reconsideration. However,
whatever his reason, the fact is the fact that's in the record.
Yes, but what I think's important is the trial court didn't rely on Mr. Smiley's letter.
How do you know?
He never referenced it. There's no reference in the record that he said, I have a letter from Mr. Smiley. He admitted conduct. No, they relied on what happened at the trial court or at Mr. Gilman's trial. And I think what's important then is we're talking about whether or not there was proximate cause. In other words, whether or not Mr. Smiley proximately caused these injuries and damages. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Goldstein. And I thank you again, Mr. Lee. The matter is deemed submitted. You can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.